The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Oh, wait, my button. Oh, there we go. I am live. I want to tell you folks that I am right now the happiest man in Dallas after hearing that speech from Doug Wilson. That was really cool. I wasn't expecting that, and that was really, really nice. So I am in a good mood, and unfortunately, he's off right away. But so I need to begin by sort of giving him a tribute. I love all of his books, but if I chose one book that maybe had the most impact on me personally and sort of professionally as a speaker, it would be Angels in the Architecture. I love that book. It really helped reclaim the Middle Ages. It did teach me that the medievals were actually Calvinists. I didn't know that, but, you know, Doug convinced me of that, whether it's true or not. But, you know, along with C.S. Lewis and others, Doug really helped me sort of reclaim the Middle Ages. And the other thing I love about Doug is his use of puns and his playfulness with language. What did he say? We drive on the parkway and park in the driveway. I thought that was actually clever. We really deserved a bigger laugh for that. I thought that was pretty funny. So let me just begin by telling you a story from the Middle Ages. It takes place about the 12th century, and it's about a man named Brother Andrew. Now, Brother Andrew was a monk, and his job was to work in the scriptorium. He was the one that made the copies, the illuminated manuscripts of the Bible. He just did beautiful work. The man lived until he was 85. He died peacefully in his sleep. The angels took him up to heaven. And when he got there, St. Peter invited him in and said, "Brother Andrew, we are so happy to have you here. You have many fans in heaven. In fact, we have a surprise. We love your work so much, we have built you a scriptorium in heaven so that you can continue to use your God-given gift." Well, Brother Andrew was so impressed and excited, he went right to work. And he's working late into the night. And somewhere in the middle of the night, Brother Andrew screams out, "Oh no! Oh no!" And all the angels and all the saints wake up and they gather around the scriptorium. "What's wrong, Brother Andrew? What's wrong?" And Brother Andrew says, "The R! The R! What's wrong, Brother Andrew? The R! Celebrate! Celebrate! What's wrong, Brother Andrew? All these years I thought it said, be ye celibate." So, watch out that you read carefully. So, that's my Doug Wilson tribute before we start. So, yesterday, I spoke on the biography of Tolkien and Lewis. Today, they're standalone, so don't worry if you weren't here yesterday. Today, I just want to focus on C.S. Lewis. And what I want to focus on is virtue in the Chronicles of Narnia. And this one's based more on my book, On the Shoulders of Hobbits. Now, those of you teaching in classical Christian schools, you've heard people say, you've even witnessed this, that our public schools no longer teach virtue. Well, that statement is not exactly true. It might be better if the public schools stop teaching virtue. What's happening is far more dangerous. In our public schools, what is taught are what I would call substitute virtues. You see, we are homo religiosus, religious man. We are also naturally moral, ethical creatures. Now, we are also fallen, but we are naturally people that should yearn after moral, ethical behavior. God wrote a conscience into us. So it's not easy to just completely throw out virtue. Then people will wake up. So what the public schools have done is substituted sort of bogus virtues. If you go to public school, this is what's taught. Multiculturalism, environmentalism, tolerance, okay, the inclusivism. This is what is. I'm not saying that those things are evil. It's good to be tolerant. But these things do not lie at the center of morality and virtue. And when you make something like tolerance the be-all and end-all of virtue, you start to deconstruct your society. So what's happening is a lot of young people and not so young people do not notice the absence of virtue because they fill themselves up with something that is a substitute. It will never totally satisfy, but it will at least dampen down the scream of your conscience and make you feel okay. This is a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much. There's many a young man in high school now who says, okay, I do sleep around, but it's okay because I recycle. Now, that may sound like an exaggeration, but it really isn't. That's what happens in the modern life. You know what tolerance really means? I'll overlook your sins if you overlook my sins. That's really what tolerance means. And that becomes the be-all and end-all of virtue. So how do we fight this? Instead of yelling and screaming till we're red in the face against these substitute virtues, what we have to do is strengthen the real virtues. The best defense, they say, is a good offense. Move forward and rekindle the real virtues. Because when we really put forward the real virtues, the young people will be able to see the difference. They will be able to see how, you know, just petty and meaningless these are compared to the true virtues. You know what the best way is to fight weeds? Now, I live in Houston, and we have a grass that actually is a weed called St. Augustine grass, but we've just come to like it, okay? Maybe we should just do this. We just have accepted it's grass when it's a weed. But the best way to fight weeds is not to pour on weed killer every day. The best way to fight weeds is to have really, really healthy grass. If you have super healthy grass, it will press out the weeds and they won't go there, right? You don't teach a bank teller how to identify phony money, counterfeit money, by giving them 20 varieties of counterfeit money. You get them to know the feel, the smell, the taste of money so well that they immediately recognize phoniness. If you've ever written, hopefully none of your students, but if a student ever wrote, plagiarized an essay in your English class, and you tell them this is plagiarized, and they say, how do you know? Young man, I read about 1,000 or more essays a year. I know what student essays sound like. If you give me a fake one, immediately the sensor's going off in my head. I may not know exactly why, but I immediately recognize that this is a counterfeit dollar. Right, so the way we fight it is by bringing back and strengthening the real virtues. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And that's really what your schools are doing. This is why I spend so much time speaking for classical Christian schools. I love what's happening because it's not only teaching knowledge, it's teaching virtue. And it's only when you put knowledge and virtue together that you get wisdom. Right? So, what, if you ask anybody, you know, not even that long ago, what is virtue? They would say the seven classical virtues. And that's what we're going to talk about. The seven classical virtues are composed of the four classical virtues, specifically, and the three theological virtues. What are the difference between the classical or cardinal virtues and the Christian or theological virtues? Well, to understand the distinction between classical and theological virtues, you need to understand the theological difference between general revelation and special revelation. And I think it's really exciting that so many classical Christian schools, starting with the ACCS itself, come out of a Reform background. Because traditionally, some of Reformation thinking has not been as comfortable with natural law, whereas Catholicism is more careful with it. But you know what? Reformed theology is based on an understanding of the difference between general and special revelation. Calvin talks about it in detail in the Institutes. It is a biblical concept, and it is at the core of what Calvin is talking about. There is a difference between what we know because we're made in the image of God and we have a conscience, and what we know because of direct revelation through the Bible. Right? So these are real concepts. In fact, the best place to read about the concept of general revelation is in the Calvinist Bible. You know what the Calvinist Bible is? The Epistle to the Romans and a few other books. You understand? That's the Calvinist Bible. Okay, Romans and a few other things. Romans 1 talks about how God's nature is shown forth in nature. And Romans 2 says that the pagans who do not have the law are a law unto themselves, for it is written upon their conscience. So Romans itself starts with a very vigorous understanding. Okay, what is general revelation? General revelation is the way that God speaks to the whole world through nature, through the conscience, Lewis would add, through the good dreams of the pagans. It's the way God reaches people that don't have the Old or New Testament. And general revelation does not save us, but it does give us a limited amount of wisdom. And throughout the Middle Ages, the Christians understood that the Greco-Roman pagans, now when I say pagan in this speech, I don't mean a UT frat boy, okay? I mean literally a Greco, sort of pre-Christian Greco-Roman writer. What we often call the virtuous or righteous pagans, we mean people like Plato and Aristotle, Homer, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Cicero, Virgil. We mean the ones that you're teaching in your school. These people that were not saved, did not have the gospel, but they seemed to have a little bit of extra light that pointed forward to the fuller revelation. And it was understood that the four classical or cardinal virtues were courage or fortitude in Latin. Courage is actually a French word. It has to do with the heart, right? Cor, the heart. Courage or fortitude. Temperance, that's Latin, or self-control. Then you had justice, which is already a Latin word, justitia, and then you had wisdom, or in Latin the word was prudence. And the understanding was that the higher pagans had an understanding of these virtues. That doesn't mean they could save themselves, but they had it. And the two major sources of the four classical virtues in the Greco world are Plato's Republic and Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. All four. And in fact, if you know Plato's Republic, Plato's Republic is an analysis of the virtue of justice. And he gets at justice by having a society that's broken into three. You have the philosopher kings who embody wisdom. You have the soldiers who embody courage. And you have the craftsmen who, if they're properly controlled, embody temperance. And when all three of those work together in harmony, you have justice. In the Nicomachean Ethics of Aristotle, he gives not a full book, but portions of a book to each one of the four classical virtues. And again, they understood those in their limited form, but this was real virtue. But it was understood that there were three higher virtues that awaited the fuller revelation of Christ and the Bible. And those three theological virtues are the ones listed in the great love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. These three things remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of them is love. Now, that doesn't mean that those words did not exist amongst the Greeks and Romans. What it means is the fullness of faith, hope, and love awaited the Christian revelation. Special revelation that comes to us from Old and New Testament, from the prophets, and supremely from Christ himself. There's two different ways, as you all know, to list the theological virtues: faith, hope, and love, or faith, hope, and charity. Now, it's the same thing. Now, here's a really peculiar thing. Many of you teach Latin here, and you know that generally speaking in our country, people are going to recognize a Latin word before they recognize a Greek word. Unless they've seen my family movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, because I am Greek, and they know that every word is Greek, okay? Even kimono apparently is Greek, which I thought is wonderful. But there's one exception to the rule, okay? I'll bet you everyone in this room, what is the Greek word that means God's self-giving love? The word? Agape, okay? Partly because of C.S. Lewis's book, The Four Loves, but almost every one of you have heard a sermon on the word agape, right? It's a beautiful Greek word. Does anybody know how to say agape in Latin? It is the word caritas. That is less known. For whatever reason, agape becomes caritas. Caritas becomes charity in the King James Bible. So faith, hope, and charity is really faith, hope, and caritas, or faith, hope, and agape. The reason I say that is I almost never say faith, hope, and charity because it's misunderstood, because in our modern day, the word charity has become reduced to mean only giving to the poor. Now, that's certainly part of caritas, but that is not the fullness of caritas. So I think we're better, sorry, King James, but I think we're better off saying faith, hope, and love, lest we be misunderstood. Okay, but that's what faith, hope, and love is. Agape, caritas, charity. What we're going to do now is I'm going to work my way through the seven virtues, explaining what they mean, and then illustrating them with a scene from one of the seven Chronicles of Narnia. Because Lewis embodies all of the seven virtues very powerfully in his set. Now, some of you know Michael Ward has shown that the seven books link up with the seven planets. The seven books don't link up with the seven virtues. They're there, here, and everywhere. One person wrote a book, an essay, on the seven deadly sins linking up to it, but I don't know, none of them work perfectly. Planet Narnia comes closest to making a real link between things. So, where do we begin? Well, there is no official ranking of the classical virtues. But I'm going to begin where C.S. Lewis would have begun, and that's with courage or fortitude. As Lewis tells us in Screwtape Letters, in some ways, courage is the most important of the classical virtues, because if you don't have it, you can't practice any of the other ones. Right? It's not more important in its own right, but without courage, you're going to give in, and you're going to sleep around. Right? As Lewis says, Pilate was merciful until it became costly. By the way, I would actually encourage you to watch the series AD. Generally speaking, it's quite good and a very good depiction of Pilate and Caiaphas. And they change a few things, but it's for public TV, it's amazingly close to the book of Acts. I encourage you to watch it with your family. It's quite good. Anyway, so we need courage. But what is courage? Okay. You've all heard the phrase from Aristotle that virtue is the golden mean, right? To metron. Unfortunately, in our day and age, many people misunderstand what the golden mean means. We think the golden mean means, I'll try anything once. That's not the golden mean. That's stupidity, okay? Are you going to try arsenic once? Go ahead, right? I mean, that's not what it means. How Aristotle will be turning in his grave, okay? What the golden mean means is virtue is the mean between the extremes. What is courage? Courage is the mean between, well, it's pretty obvious what's over here, cowardice, okay? But courage is not only not cowardice, courage is not cockiness running in stupidly like a, what do you call those people, like a, what's the word I want? Banshee, no, not banshee, what's the word? When the soldier goes crazy. What is it? Berserker, thank God, I don't know why it wouldn't come to me. Okay, the berserker, I'm scared because any day I expect a berserker to blow up my city of Houston. I think that's why I blocked that word. But this berserker going, scream, that is not courage. Or Aristotle would say that's not courage. That's the other extreme. That's foolhardy. True courage works with knowledge and wisdom. It needs to know what it is doing and what it is risking. Right? Now, a lot of soldiers are courageous, but courage obviously is not only something that soldiers embody. Courage, especially for Cicero and for Socrates, courage meant staying your ground. Courage means sticking to your post. Now, if you're a soldier, it's pretty obvious what your post is. But if you're a mother, or you're a school teacher, or you're a doctor, sticking to your post is staying at your post no matter how scary things get. You stay there. In fact, it's a misunderstanding that the Romans had a high view of suicide. Usually it's the bad guys that commit suicide anyway. Mark Antony and Brutus, from their point of view, from the winner's point of view, those are the bad guys. No, Cicero says suicide's wrong. Not for a Christian reason. They didn't really understand that, you know, our body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Suicide is wrong because suicide is literally abandoning the post at which the gods put you. Courage means endurance. It means sticking through. Do you know in the Republic, Plato compares courage to one of those color fast dyes that don't wash out. Courage stays the course. It stays true. It endures. So often, we think of courage as self-glorification, rushing in and, you know, being the hero. Oftentimes, what courage really means is a kind of self-emptying. the courage that will allow itself to be a bridge to protect and save other people. There are a lot of battles in the Chronicles of Narnia, but the greatest display of courage in the Chronicles is when Aslan, the Christ of Narnia, lays down his life on the stone table. That is the greatest act of courage, and notice it is an action that comes out of a position of strength, not out of a position of weakness. Aslan lays his own life down. It's not taken away from him. It is laid down. That is a display of courage that is more remarkable sometimes than somebody rushing in killing 100 people. In fact, I'm sure most of you know the line, The Witch in the Wardrobe. When he has been beaten and kicked and a muzzle's been put on him and his hair has been shaven and he's about to be killed, Lucy looks at him, sees him, and suddenly, Lewis says, Aslan looked braver and stronger than he had ever looked before. Courage. And folks, we normally think of courage as the ability to endure physical pain. And that is certainly part of courage. But I would argue that it often takes more courage to endure emotional pain. You know, there are a lot of Christians in a moment would rush forward and proclaim Christ and be killed. But that same Christian might be too afraid to speak up when his colleagues at the water fountain are making fun of Christians. Does that sound weird? But sometimes it takes more courage to stand forward and be embarrassed or be humiliated. Let me go back to this physical emotional, because it's a very important dichotomy, and Lewis picks up on it in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Okay, I'm a Baptist. If you've ever been to a Baptist church, every time Easter comes around, they are always going to bring some tall engineer guy to come in and explain to you in excruciating detail how painful it is to die by crucifixion. You've all heard the speech? Come on, okay? It's important, okay? But they will come in and explain to you in excruciating detail. Now, that was incredibly terrible. But the pain that Jesus endured, the physical pain, did not last very long. I'm sure if you ask Jesus, what was the worst part of the crucifixion? I don't think he would say the physical pain on the cross. I think he would say the betrayal, the humiliation, being spit upon, his own people turning against him. We all know this is true. Do you know that our bodies do not remember physical pain? If you got really, really hurt 10 years ago, you can't sit here and re-feel the pain. You can remember that it hurt, but our body does not remember pain. You know what the proof of that is? Women have more than one child, okay? Thank God. If we remember pain, everybody would be an only child, right? So our bodies don't, but I want you to think about this. Let's say when you were 10 years old, your father chewed you out and told you were worthless and useless and ugly. Right now, let's say you're 40 years old, 30 years later, if you sit here and think back to when you were chewed out, what will happen to you? You know what will happen to you? Your face will start to get red. You will start to sweat. You might even start to cry. You will actually physically, emotionally re-experience it. So we've got to get that. I don't want to in any way do away with the physical pain, but we need to understand the unbelievable courage that Christ showed in being willing to be humiliated for Christ. There's a lot of guys that will step in front of the bullet for their wife, but they won't sit there and let her cry in his shoulder for an hour. Right? Again, courage. Look, my daughter's with us. She's not here today because Anastasia, I hope you'll meet her, wants to be a music teacher at a classical Christian school, so she's at the music speech right now. I said, go there. You need to learn about this. You've heard this speech before. But when my daughter was about 5 years old, how many of you have seen the animated version of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Have you seen it? It's very low budget, but it's very, very well done. It's good, especially if you've got, you know, a third or fourth grade. It's very well done. It's very faithful. They leave out Father Christmas, which is kind of weird anyway. But, I mean, it's very, very faithful, very well done. And I still remember when we watched that as a family, my son and my daughter, Stacey was about five, Anastasia, and after it was over, do you know what bothered her the most about the crucifixion scene on the stone table? She kept saying it over and over again. I can't believe they cut his hair. I can't believe they cut his hair. She understood, as a 5-year-old, the humiliation of what was done to Aslan. Okay? So, again, I don't want to take away from the physical aspect of courage, but we need to understand that in our country, we're slow out of the place where we're going to be killed for our faith, even, generally speaking, not be put in jail for our faith. But we will be humiliated, and we will be laughed at. Will you stand up? Not in a pharisaical way. Will you just stand up and be willing? Because I think, you know what happens to so many Christian schools that go bad? So many faculty that go bad? You know why? One verse of the Bible. Woe to you when all men speak well of you. That's why academics turn away. Because you probably think that if somebody has a PhD, that they have more self-esteem. No, most PhDs have lower self-esteem. They're actually more concerned by what other people think about them than somebody that maybe didn't even go to undergraduate. Right? Sometimes the more educated you are, the more refined you are, and the more scared you are of any kind of cognitive dissonance and being embarrassed. That's one of the biggest reasons. That's one of the biggest reasons why they're afraid to even talk about anything but Darwin. Right? Oh, no, they're going to look at me as an idiot. I'm going to be a fundamentalist, you see? Got to get away from that. If you have courage, you've got to be willing not only to die with Christ, but to be laughed at with Christ, which, oddly enough, sometimes takes more courage. Okay? You all are often laughed at for the classical Christian school system. Those of you that have homeschooled your children for part of the way are often laughed at. No, you have to stand up brave and say, okay, I'm willing to be laughed at for that. Okay? That's good. In fact, it's a good sign if I'm being laughed at. I must be doing something right. Okay? So courage is the first one. Let's move on to temperance. Now, the word temperance is a lot like the word charity, by which I mean it's another word whose meaning has been reduced. Today, when you hear the word temperance, you think Southern Baptist, okay? Not drinking. Now, there's a reason for that. There was a movement called the temperance movement against alcoholism. And to prove to you that politics makes strange bedfellows, the temperance movement is the only time in history when conservative Christians and feminists work together. That's the old days when feminists actually cared about women and family, right? Instead of just other feminists, right? But it's kind of weird, but they worked together for a while. But that's not the classical virtue of temperance. The classical virtue of temperance is between, you know, overindulgence, a sort of licentiousness, and then over-asceticism. Okay, it's not about not drinking, okay? Temperance is about, again, moderation, self-control. It's funny, I'm a Baptist. We don't know what to do with C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis is the closest that we have to a saint. He's Saint Jack. But he smoked and drank. And I've seen a few Baptist publications where there's a picture of Lewis and they've airbrushed out the cigarette. And by the way, we have tried to reconcile ourselves by thinking of Lewis as smoking a pipe. Lewis did smoke a pipe. He also smoked at least a pack of cigarettes a day. I'd like to pretend like he didn't, but he knew he smoked too much. But, you know, the pipe thing is kind of cool. Okay. Temperance, again, is a mean between the extremes. It is finding the right balance. You know what the best definition of temperance is? It is the Ecclesiastes that was turned to the song, there is a season, turn. There's a season for this and a time for this. And one of the things we have lost in our country, especially if you're in a lower Protestant denomination like I am, is we've lost the concept of the sacred year, the feast and the fast. We've lost the concept of that. We now have Mardi Gras without Lent. Okay? We just have Mardi Gras as an end in itself, right? We've lost that concept of there being a season for everything. That's much closer to the idea of temperance. This scene was left out of the live-action movie, sadly, although they allude to it. In Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, most of you know, the witch has used her magic to make it 100 years of winter, so it's always winter and never Christmas. But when Aslan returns, Father Christmas comes back, right? And in the scene, if you remember, the witch is on her sleigh trying to get to the stone table before the children, and she has Edmund with her. And as they're going along, the snow starts to melt because winter is dying, right? As opposed to, what is that show, Game of Thrones, winter is coming. You know what Game of Thrones is? The Lord of the Rings without a moral center. That's what the Lord of Game of Thrones is. It's a guilty pleasure, but anyway, I don't watch it with my wife. I watch it alone and feel guilty, but I still watch it. Anyway, but they come upon, and what happens is they have to get out of the sleigh and walk because it's all grass. and they come upon a group of party animals. I'm not going back to UT again. I mean, literally a group of party animals. Animals who are partying. Because Father Christmas has given them food and wine. Now, when the witch sees the party animals, she says this. What is the meaning of all this gluttony, all this waste, all this self-indulgence? Who gave you these things? And when they insist that Father Christmas, she uses her wand and turns them all to stone. Now, some of you might have grown up in a very, very overly strict family where you imagined Jesus saying those words, what is the meaning of all this gluttony, this waste, this self-indulgence? No, it is the devil who is the cosmic killjoy, right? If you want to party with someone, you want to party with Jesus. You want to party with the guy who turned water into wine. Except in my church where he turned it into grape juice. But that's the person you want, you know. If you're a Catholic priest, you can't have sex, but you can have all the wine you want. If you are a Baptist pastor, you can have all the sex you want, but you can't have any wine. That's why you become a Presbyterian, as many of you have. You just have it all, okay? But we've got to understand that temperance doesn't mean being overly ascetic. There is a time for Aslan is always throwing parties for everybody. And as far as I can tell, he's giving wine to the 12-year-olds. They always leave that out of the Focus on the Family version, by the way. But he's always giving wine to these kids. What are they doing? But we need to understand that, again, Jesus is the one. Most Baptists, you ask us our favorite verse, it's John 3:16. Of course, I love John 3:16. But my favorite verse is John 10:10. The thief, that is Satan, the thief comes only to steal, to kill, and to destroy. But I, Christ, I come that you might have life and have it to the full or have it abundantly. Right? That is the life that Christ gives us. It is the devil. I'm convinced the devil is a teetotaler. The devil gives us wine, not for joy, but to turn us into drunkards. And when do you know how you know when you become a drunkard? When you start drinking alone, and your drinking breaks fellowship with your friends and family. Now, the devil has grabbed you, and this thing that's supposed to bring joy and bring families together has now torn them apart. But the devil doesn't want us to have fun, right? The devil wants us to take fun and use it in the wrong way. But God wants us to find temperance, the mean between the extremes. Prince Caspian. As a movie, I enjoyed Prince Caspian, but of the three movies they've made, it departs the farthest from the book. It pretty much misses the mark in almost everything, though I still enjoyed the movie. And one of the things the movie loses, and it's really sad, because one of the most brilliant things about that book is what C.S. Lewis does with two dwarves, the black dwarf, whose name is Nicabrick, and the red dwarf, whose name is Trumpkin. Now, it's in the movie, but it's not quite as clear as it is in the book. When the book starts, both Nicabrick and Trumpkin are, in a sense, atheists. They don't believe in Aslan. They don't believe in the four children. It's all stuff and nonsense. They're both kind of cynical. But what happens is, over the course of the novel, they bifurcate. So Trumpkin grows into one of the great heroes of Narnia. Nicabrick goes so sour, he almost brings back the White Witch, and then he's killed and dies a sort of pathetic death. Okay, the movie, because it rearranges the plot, misses what Lewis does in the book. Over like 7 or 8 chapters, Lewis gives us 7 or 8 clues of which is going to go which way. The first clue is when young Prince Caspian is taken in by Nicabrick, Trumpkin, and Truffle Hunter, the badger. Nicabrick immediately wants to kill him because he's a human, but Trumpkin says, no, he is our guest. He knows that classical virtue of xenia or hospitality, you don't kill a guest. Right? Later on, Nicabrick wants to get help from hags. Trumpkin says, no, we can't work with those people. They're evil. Like, there's a whole bunch of little clues. But my favorite clue, and I'm not making this up, we know Nicabrick is going to be the bad one because, 1, he doesn't smoke, and 2, he doesn't dance. I'm not making this up. Read Prince Caspian. There is this great scene when they meet on Dancing Lawn and all the fawns show up and they start having a wild dance. And it says, everybody joined the dance. Even Trumpkin, though he was very, you know, kind of creaky, joined the dance. Only Nicabrick refused to dance. He won't join the dance of life. He rejects the joy in its proper place. Now, Trumpkin is that, you know how Trumpkin dance? Do you know how engineers dance? Any of you ladies married to an engineer? This is how an engineer dances. Sort of like the Frankenstein monster. Okay, so, but Trumpkin got up and danced. Give your husband a club. He got up and danced. So get him a difference. If he's stiff, get up there and dance. Join the dance of life. Right? That's the important thing. The movie misses something else that just, I was so upset. This would have been the most cinematic thing they could have done. If you know anything about, I teach film as well. If you know anything about film, there's this thing called parallel editing, where two things are happening at the same time, and you cut back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. It's really, really exciting, right? Goes all the way back to D.W. Griffith, sort of started it. Wonderful. Okay. They lost the opportunity to do that. Because while Peter and Edmund are having the duel with Miraz while the boys are fighting, does anybody remember what the girls are doing? The girls are on the back of Aslan, rushing through the countryside, waking up the trees. Now, in the name of feminism, the girls are no longer allowed to wake up the trees. Susan now gets a bow and arrow and kills 100 people. How that liberates women, how that praises femininity, I don't know, okay? I'm sure if you got girls aside without anybody looking or listening and asked them, would you rather kill 100 people or ride on the back of Aslan and wake up the trees? I think I know what the answer is going to be, as long as they don't think anybody's listening and they're ashamed, right? So anyway, they leave out the whole scene with that, and that's beautiful. And if you know the novel, who helps Aslan wake up the trees? Bacchus, the Greek god of wine, women, and song, the Greek god of fraternities, right? I mean, what is he doing there, right? Well, if you heard my speech yesterday, Bacchus is one of those corn kings, those dying and rising gods. He is a Christ figure. Not Christ, you know, he's very violent and whatnot. But there, basically what you get with Bacchus is a sort of divine revelry or a divine madness. And sometimes that divine madness is needed to break something open, right? And again, the countryside is awakened in a good use of revelry. The revelry doesn't last forever, right? Because it will give way to a time of somberness, right? And soberness. But there needs to be a balance between the two, and that is incarnated in Narnia, in the good characters, at least. Balance. Number three is wisdom. Who is the wisest person in the Bible? Was Solomon. Okay. You can write this down. Solomon was not a rocket scientist. When I give this speech in Houston, there's always at least one rocket scientist in the room. I have nothing against rocket scientists. But we have lost our understanding, not classical Christian schools, but America in general has lost our understanding of the difference between wisdom and knowledge. We have taken the classical virtue of wisdom and turned it into specialized knowledge. Now, I'm not completely against specialization. If there's something wrong with my eye, I would like to go to an eye specialist. There's a reason for specialization in math, in the sciences, in engineering. There's a reason for that. But unfortunately, it has crept into the humanities and has really ruined the humanities via the social sciences, has come in and now, who do we listen to? We don't listen to the Solomons. We don't listen to the wise old men who have experience and wisdom. We listen to the specialists who we think can tell us how to lead better lives. Usually a specialist is somebody who knows a whole heck of a lot about that and knows absolutely nothing about anything else. Okay? Right? And the worst is, I don't want to make fun of doctors, but haven't you met a lot of doctors who are brilliant and therefore think they're brilliant at everything else? And usually they don't understand anything else, especially finances. They always lose their money unless they listen to their wife. So we have to be careful with this. Again, I'm not against specialization has its role, but that's not what wisdom is. Wisdom comes out of the liberal arts. It's what you're teaching your students. It comes with a wider understanding of things that's more humanistic, right? That takes in virtue. Remember this. The Titanic was built by experts. Noah was an amateur. Okay. I want you to remember that. Whether or not he looked like Russell Crowe, I don't know. But Noah was an amateur. Remember that, okay? Wisdom is, again, something that you develop over time. It's a breadth of vision. It's not just memorizing facts. Now, again, we all believe in starting with grammar. There's nothing wrong with learning the facts, but we want you to slowly grow in virtue and piety to have wisdom. Now, there is a part in the last battle, the last of the seven chronicles, that helps us understand wisdom by showing us what happens when we lose wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. What happens when we lose the fear of the Lord and we lose wisdom? This is one of the most brilliant, but also one of the saddest moments in the Chronicles of Narnia. The last battle has got to be the strangest children's book ever written. It ends with all the children discovering that they're dead and they're happy. This is amazing. Maybe it was right before final exams. I don't know. But, I mean, they're just saying, yay, we don't have to go home. This is the craziest thing, but it's beautiful. Okay. Some of you know, it's the most complex in some ways of the seven chronicles, because there's this stable. And when you go through the stable door, you've died and crossed over to the other side. Now, there are a group of dwarves who have turned against Aslan, who have become cynical, who have become skeptical, who say, the dwarves are for the dwarves, who say, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on me, they will never be fooled again, right? And they have rejected everything, and they've just started killing everybody. They kill the Narnian horses. Can any of you mad? Kill the Narnian horses. Okay. Now, near the end of the novel, the good characters are in the stable, and they look around and they find themselves essentially in a restored Garden of Eden, a place of beauty, the sights, the smells, the sounds. Wonderful. And then they see that the dwarves are with them. But the odd thing is that the dwarves are all huddled together and they don't seem to notice any of the trees, the fruit, the sky, the water. They seem oblivious to it. And they go and try to talk to them. And they try to hold up a front. Oh, what are you doing? Huh? Because you see, the dwarves believe that they're in a pokey, smelly, dingy little stable. And they cannot see where they are. And the children try to do all sorts of things using touch and sound and smell and taste. But they can no longer see or smell or taste or touch it. Everything's been thrown out of whack. The modern understanding of wisdom and specialization is empiricism. Only if my five senses perceive it, is it true. Now, the dwarves, who have given up wisdom, who have lost the fear of God, can no longer trust their senses because they've lost their wisdom. And then Aslan shows up, right? Lucy says, Aslan, can't you do something for them? He says, daughter, I will show you exactly what I can and what I cannot do. Calvinist, close your ears with God saying, cannot do. Just don't worry about that. Okay. I will show you what I can and cannot do. He shakes his mane, he roars, and a feast is laid out. More wine, everything. Pigeon toes, whatever these British eat. Spread out, okay? You know what I love about the British? They sent sailors all over the world to India and places to bring back expensive, exotic spices that they do not use in their food. Somebody explain that to me. I don't understand it. But anyway, okay. If it wasn't for the Indians in India, in London, there would be no spice at all. It would just be meat and potatoes forever with the Germans and just go on forever. But anyway. So, he lays out a feast, and they immediately devour it greedily, but it becomes very soon clear that they don't know what they're eating. They think they're just eating dirty stubble and hay and water out of a trough, and they're fighting and smeared all over their faces. Ah! Finally, Aslan turns to the children and says, you see, they will not let us help them. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is only in their own mind, but they are in that prison and so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out. You know what I love about Lewis? One of the most educated academic men of the 20th century, and yet he can make puns that are better than any youth pastor can come up with. You notice that? So afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out. That's not the way PhDs usually speak. That is the direct way of showing language and helping us understand. Folks, one of the things that you are fighting in your classroom, and you're fighting a good fight, you're fighting cynicism. That is the death. David Diener spoke earlier today about wonder. If you want to kill education, if you want to kill wisdom, give them cynicism and give them skepticism. My daughter, Anastasia, I hope you get a chance to meet her. She's in the Honors College at HBU, where I teach, Houston Baptist University. And they were studying Eusebius' ecclesiastical history. He's the one that tells the history of the early church up to Constantine. And for Eusebius, Constantine was a hero because he stopped the persecution. There were many students, believing students, these are not secular, these are believing students, who became very cynical and said, I don't trust Eusebius. All he wants to do is make Constantine look good, and that's it. And they wouldn't listen. And my daughter, what are you talking about? You're going to throw everything out because he has an agenda? As if you don't have an agenda? Go girl, right? But again, cynicism is one of the strongest things that will protect us against the good, the true, and the beautiful. Cynicism builds a crust around us, a wall. We need to fight it. And we need to fight it because the modern world thinks that cynicism is wisdom. It is not. Cynicism kills wisdom. The dwarves are in a prison of their own making, but they are in that prison. They will not be taken out because they've refused to give in again. At least I know that I haven't given in to any nonsense or any pie in the sky by and by, and there they stay in darkness, unable to move into the light. As you draw your children, not only your own children, but the students you have, as you draw them out of darkness and cynicism, you draw them into light and wonder and awe and beauty. That's wisdom, okay? Wisdom that we need to seek after, like after a beautiful woman in the Proverbs. Wow. The last classical virtue is justice. Now, if I was giving this speech to a regular audience, it would be a real hard sell, what I'm about to say. It's going to be a left part of the sell for you guys. Thankfully, that's why I love to come speak here. Because justice is not synonymous with fairness. Okay? Fairness is a concern of adolescent children. Okay? Mature adults care about justice. Right? When your child says, that's not fair, the proper response is, life is not fair, get over it. Justice does not mean treating everyone the same. Justice means treating people in the way that they are to be treated. Now, look at me. I'm a Baptist. I'm an American. But you know what? You're never going to understand beauty or justice or goodness until you understand hierarchy. It's a weird thing for a Baptist to say, right? But I grew up Greek Orthodox, so I've got hierarchy in my blood. We need to understand that there is a hierarchy. There's only two ways that we are all equal. We are all equal before the law, thank God for that in our country, and we are all equal because we are of equal intrinsic worth and value in the eyes of our Creator. But other than that, we are different, and thank God for that difference. My university, this is about 15, 20 years ago, like a lot of Christian schools, actually had a beauty contest. It was a very tasteful beauty contest. There was no swimsuit thing, right? And they got rid of it. Why did they get rid of it? They got rid of it because it discriminated against girls that were less pretty. And I remember answering, well, then I hope you're going to get rid of the football team. Because that discriminates against boys that are less athletic. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, can you imagine if we took our egalitarian principles that want to make everybody the same and used it in our Houston Symphony? Our Houston Symphony would very quickly not be the Houston Symphony, right? We don't do that. We don't do that with our actors. We don't do it. We certainly don't do it with the doctors that work on us. Okay? What is this rage to make everybody the same? Okay? The definition of justice in the Republic, right, is treating everybody in accordance with their proper worth. Folks, there is a movement amongst Christians that says Jesus is all about radical inclusivism and egalitarianism. Jesus is about equality, if you mean equal value, but Jesus was not an egalitarian that wanted to make everybody the same. And when somebody says, yes, he was an egalitarian, and I say, give me a scripture, you know what scripture they're going to give me? The foot washing, right? Jesus washes the disciples' feet. Doesn't that prove that Jesus is breaking down all distinctions forever and making everybody the same? Well, not if you actually read the passage. Okay? It's John chapter 12. Read John chapter 12 carefully, and you will notice that the story begins by saying, Jesus, knowing that the Father had put all authority in his hands, put on the robe and bent down. So it's from a position of strength and authority that Jesus washes their feet. Now, after he washes their feet, he says, do you know why I did this? Okay. This would be a perfect place for Jesus to say, I did this because we are all egalitarians now and everybody is the same and there are no more distinctions. He had the perfect opportunity. Do you know what he said instead? He said the very opposite. He said, you call me teacher and Lord, and you are right to do so. We're not breaking down any distinctions, but now that you see I, your teacher and Lord, wash your feet, do it to one another. He is not breaking down authority. He is giving us a new concept of stewardship, of leader as servant, servant leadership. The Teddy Roosevelt said that the stewardship of the presidency, the president as a steward. That's very different than breaking down all distinctions. He says, now I am a model for you. And by the way, in case anybody missed it, Jesus goes on to end the story by saying a phrase that he says again and again in the Gospels, the Synoptic and John. He says, the servant is not greater than his master. The ambassador or the messenger is not greater than the one who sent them. Now you understand. And then he finishes. So again, he had the perfect opportunity. No, justice is treating people in accordance with the word. You don't treat everybody the same. Okay? Look, let me show you how words have lost their meaning. I'm 51 years old. That's not too old. Okay? When I was younger, a man would be called a sexist if he treated women exactly the same way he treated men. He would be a sexist. Today, you're a sexist. You're a sexist if you don't treat men and women exactly the same. You understand the change? Okay? We've lost all sort of gentility, right? It used to be a sexist was somebody who refused to accept the differences and honor women as women. A sexist used to be somebody who expected women to act exactly like men. Okay? Today, that's the feminists. Okay? Feminists are actually misogynists. Some of them, I don't mean all of them, the radical ones, are almost misogynists because they don't like femininity. Okay? So, justice. Okay? The most poisonous thing that children are taught today in public schools and even some Christian schools is that there are no essential differences between men and women. They're all exactly the same and it's all socialization. Right? No. We have lost a sense of who we are. We've lost a sense of our role in society, of wherever it is. We've lost justice is treating people in accordance with who they are. Look, in The Magician's Nephew, Diggory Kirk, who will become the professor, does a lot of bad things, and he causes evil to be ushered into Narnia on the very day of its creation. What does Aslan do to protect Narnia? He does two things. First, he gives Diggory a mission, and I'm going to end with that in a little bit. Then he brings forward Frank the cab driver and his wife Nellie and makes them the first king and queen of Narnia. He establishes a kingship, a hierarchy, to protect Narnia and in a sense to make Narnia free. Later on, in Prince Caspian, there's a scene where Prince Caspian is talking about how Narnia, sons of Adam, are supposed to be kings of Narnia, not talking animals. And Truffle Hunter the Badger says, yes, Narnia is a place for sons of Adam to be king. And Nicobrick says, what? You're an animal. Why do you want to, this is, Narnia is for talking animals, not for humans. And Truffle Hunter says, I know that. That's not what I said. Narnia is a place for talking animals, but it's a place for a son of Adam to be king. And nothing was right except when a son of Adam. So he understands his place, where he is, right? He understands the proper hierarchy and doesn't break down that. Are you fans of the silver chair? When Prince Rillian comes back, even though he's all gaunt and all that stuff, people immediately recognize him as king. There's something in his walk. How many of you have been to a Renaissance festival? We've actually got the best one in Houston, one of the best in the country. Okay. We used to take my kids there every year. I love the Renaissance Festival. But you know what? Every time I go, I stand there in the middle, and I look around me, and I say, oh my God, all the people around me are people who I would disagree with on every single issue of life. And yet they're here. These are people who hate everything the Middle Ages stands for, and yet they're here. I think we have a natural love of hierarchy and beauty. I think it's built into us. We may deny it, and yet we're drawn to it. Why are all these people going to see Chronicles of Narnia and Lord of the medieval places? They stand for everything that our culture says it's against, and yet we are drawn towards it. There is a beauty there. And if you don't understand beauty, you're not going to understand hierarchy or justice. They all go together. There is a rank. Doesn't mean that we're still... Let me end with this, and then we'll move to the theological virtues, okay? Again, as a C.S. Lewis scholar, I get to write for lots of different magazines. And I've written for all different denominations. And it took me a long time to realize what was happening. I'm a pretty traditional person, so I tend to say St. Augustine and St. Paul. And I discovered that whenever it was, you know, a Catholic Anglican publication, they didn't change it. But I suddenly realized, whenever it was Baptist or low Protestant, they changed it to the Apostle Paul or Augustine. It took me a long time to realize they were doing that. And I didn't try, you know, I respect their way they do it. But it suddenly struck me that, you know, Baptists, I mean, in a sense, Protestants are right when we say everyone's a saint. I mean, if you read the Bible very carefully, we are all saints. And that really gets back, oh, those Catholics. Okay, look. First of all, Baptists do have saints. We call them missionaries, okay? But it took me a long time to realize that the real reason Baptists and low Protestants get mad at the idea of sainthood, it's not because of the Bible. They get mad because they are, oh, so you think you're better than I am. That's the real... You'll never vocalize that because nobody ever admits to envy. We'll admit to lust, we'll admit to anger, we'll admit to pride. We never admit to envy because it's such a pathetic sin. But that's what it is. Oh, you think you're better than me? You see what I mean? Well, yeah, in some ways I am. In this, okay? Do I have any problem saying that Itzhak Perlman is a better musician than I am? No problem. None of you should have that problem unless you're really, really good at the violin. So no problem, okay? But again, we've got to get away from this, right? We've got to celebrate difference and celebrate. Lewis says in heaven, if I invent a praise of God using my gifts, I will enjoy that praise just as much as if someone else wrote it. And when someone else writes the praise, I will enjoy it just as much as if I wrote it. That's what he means when he says there's no ownership in heaven. Lewis is not a Marxist. There's no ownership because we all take joy that God is praised. Okay, let's move quickly over and look a little bit at the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love. Let's start with the wrong definition of faith. Has anybody ever heard the little boy's definition of faith? Faith means believing in things I know isn't true. That's not faith, that's stupidity. Okay, we're back to, I'll try anything once. Actually, faith is one of the few things that the Bible gives us a definition for. Those of you that love definitions, you find it in Hebrews 13:1, right? Faith is the evidence of things not seen, the assurance of things hoped for. Faith is a radically new way of seeing, right? It's seeing the kingdom. In fact, if you read John chapter 3 with Nicodemus, Jesus equates entering the kingdom with seeing the kingdom. To see the kingdom is to enter it. It is to have the eyes of faith. When Jesus says the Beatitudes, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted, you have to have eyes of faith that can see through the mourning to the other side, to the joy that comes in the morning, M-O-R-N, on the other side of M-O-U-R-N, mourning. Those are eyes, right? We have eyes of faith. Faith is that, this is how I define it, it's that which sees the kairos. Some of you know that there are two words for time in Greek. One is chronos, which means chronological time. Chronometer is an old-fashioned word for a watch. But kairos, or kairos, means the opportune time, the moment when everything comes together, the crisis, the opportune. Jesus was born in the fullness of time. The kairos is the special time when everything comes together. And faith gives us the eyes to see that. One of the most wonderful moments in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is when they're at the beaver's house for dinner and all of the prophecies start coming together. Wrong will be right when Aslan comes in sight. At the sound of his roar, sorrow will be no more. When he bares his teeth, winter meets its death. and when he shakes his mane, we shall have spring again. Right? There's that wonderful old prophecy of Aslan. But at the same dinner, we hear another prophecy. When Adam's flesh and Adam's bone sits at Ker Peravel enthroned, the evil times will be over and done. Isn't it exciting when we put together the prophecy that Mr. Beaver does and start to realize what God is doing, and our eyes of faith show us that all the prophecies are coming together? Does anybody know what the longest chapter in the Lord of the Rings is called? The longest chapter in the Lord of the Rings is called? Anybody know? It's the Council of Elrond. Remember, it goes on forever. But it's really exciting because all the movie wisely breaks that up. But when you're reading, it's okay. And all the pieces come together, bit by all the prophecies, and you start realizing what's happening. It's really, really exciting. Do you know I wish I could have been St. Paul after his conversion. Because you all know that if you put together the epistles, Paul spent maybe as much as 3 years in the desert preparing himself. Right? You know that. And can you imagine? Remember, he was a Pharisee. He probably had most of the Old Testament memorized. Can you imagine being Paul as you sat out in the desert and ran through the Old Testament in your head, and suddenly it's a totally new book? Right? Suddenly you realize, oh my gosh, this is what it means. They did a beautiful job in AD on Sunday with the Ethiopian eunuch, suddenly realizing what Isaiah 53 means. Oh my gosh, the eyes of faith must have opened and opened and opened and opened, right? The eyes of faith in Prince Caspian, Dr. Cornelius, and young Prince Caspian have eyes of faith because they are looking for the signs of old Narnia. Dr. Cornelius says, sometimes my prince, I almost despair, but something keeps me going. The sound of drums in the hill, the patter of feet. He's looking for the sign. We need eyes of faith to see and recognize the signs that are all around us. Or we can be the opposite of that. In the last battle, King Tyrion, the last king of Narnia, he does become a hero at the end. But in the beginning, he lacks the eyes of faith. He believes the lie that Aslan has returned. The centaur tells him, Lord, this is not true. There are liars among men. There are no liars amongst the stars. If Aslan came, all the most wonderful stars would come into conjunction. I have never seen worse conjunction in my life. Tyrion, it's a lie. Have eyes of faith. This cannot be Aslan. This must be a false Aslan. But in his rashness, he loses his faith for a moment, and he loses the eyes that see. We live by faith. We look through to see the truth and the comfort on the other side. A fuller understanding. That's how we can live by faith. I've had a few students who drive by faith. They're scary, okay? But we need to live by faith. All right. Of the three theological virtues, faith, hope, and love, the one I think that gets the worst press today, the one that has been lost, the one that people don't know what to do with, is actually hope. To a lot of people, hope is pie in the sky, by and by. Hope is looking at the world with rose-colored glasses. People look down on hope. Freud saw hope as wish fulfillment, okay? Weakness. For Marx and Marxism, hope is actually bad because hope stops you from building the utopia on earth that the Marxists keep trying to build and keep making dystopias. Hope is often attacked. That's foolish. That's naive. Okay? Oh, I hate so much. Two of the things I love are Frank Capra movies. I've taught Frank Capra. And Roger Hammerstein musicals. And if you want two things in our country that are attacked for being rose-colored glasses, did you ever actually see any of these movies? Okay. Frank Capra movies are very, very dark. Let's look at the one that gets made fun of the most, It's a Wonderful Life. That is an extremely dark movie. Okay. And the hope only comes at the end. He's about to kill himself. And darkness is all around him. Right? And yet, hope comes out in the end. That it comes through the chaos. Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Have you ever seen that movie? You do understand that Mr. Smith loses, okay? He collapses. The only reason he wins is because his belief in hope changes Senator Payne, the character, the White Knight, and he confesses. But our hero is unconscious at the end of the movie. Right? So Frank Capra understands that hope doesn't mean, again, silliness or rose-colored. It means looking directly through things, but seeing, having hopes, resting on the promises. What about Rodgers and Hammerstein? Oh, my gosh. These are silly, sentimental movies. Have you ever watched any or seen any? Okay. The King and I is about an impossible romance. She can't marry this guy. All his wives. Okay. South Pacific, okay? That's a movie about what they used to call miscegenation, mixing of the races. A very, very serious movie. Oklahoma, Judd dies and everybody laughs, okay? And the best of all is The Sound of Music. Everybody makes fun of that. I am 16 going on 17. And then the boy says, I am 17 going on 18. I'll take it. Or I'll become a Nazi and turn your family in. I don't understand. Maybe they haven't watched the movie. Okay? Every one of the Rogers, even State Fair has a dark side. That's the cheeriest one. Even that has a dark side. Everyone has a dark side. Every one of Frank Capra's movies has a dark side. But there is an overwhelming hope that sustains you in the end. How many of you have ever read On Fairy Stories by Tolkien? Okay, wonderful. It's one of the best things ever written on fairy tales and on Lord of the Rings, but fairy tales in general. He coins a word in there that helps us understand hope. And the word he coins is eucatastrophe. By the way, that's a Greek word, not a Latin word. EU is the Greek word that means good, as in eugenics, well-born. And catastrophe, kata means down, strophe means turn. A catastrophe is a downturn. A eucatastrophe is a good downturn. And what he's talking about is that in the best fairy stories, there's a eucatastrophe, because everything is going down. Then suddenly, when all hope is lost, there is a sudden upturning, a sudden moment of grace. Now, sometimes I don't understand Tolkien. Tolkien, the good Catholic, says, I've had to invent eucatastrophe because there's no word for it. Would you just study a little Catholic theology? Have you ever heard of the word felix culpa? You know what that is? Felix culpa. Felix means happy, as in felicity. Culpa means guilt, as in culpable. Felix culpa means happy guilt or happy fault or happy fall. Felix culpa is a reference to the fall of man. Now, have these Catholic theologians lost their mind? They're calling the fall a happy event? Well, in and of itself, it is not a happy event. It's a terrible event. But viewed through the eyes of the theological virtue of hope, the fall is good because it leads to the greater outpouring of love that we call the incarnation, when God became man. Or, what do we Christians call the day Jesus was crucified? Good? Have we lost our mind? Good? Are we postmodernists and words go? I don't think that word means what you think it means, okay? Have we lost our minds? It's Good Friday, not in and of itself. In and of itself, it's the worst day in human history. But viewed through the eyes of hope, the eucatastrophe, it is good, for it leads to the resurrection. Good Friday leads to Easter Sunday. That is the theological virtue of hope. Right? We see it in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the replay of the death and resurrection of Christ. He is killed on the stone table. But it is, okay, it's not just self-sacrificial love that is saving us. The dying is actually the very force that leads to the overthrow of the White Witch and the overthrow of the devil. Right? It is through the death of Christ. I told you I grew up Greek Orthodox. At Easter, the Orthodox sing a beautiful hymn, Christ is risen from the dead, by death trampling upon death, and to those in the tombs he granted life. Christos anesthe ek nekron. Now, in Greek it sounds better, of course. In Greek, this is the word order exactly. Christ is risen from the dead, by death, death trampling. Right? The first word is, a lot of you know Latin, it's a dative, by death. Is one word, followed by the word death. By death, death trampling. It's like magic poetry, what Doug Wilson just talked about. It's magic poetry. Through his death, he defeated and destroyed death. Right? By succumbing to the deep magic, Aslan releases the deeper magic, right? But it couldn't have been released. The hope comes in the morning. Finally, let's end with love. Love is that which pities and forgives. But let's be careful with the word pity. Pity is a beautiful word that has been corrupted by the enemy. Pity can be one of the most manipulative things. But true pity, true empathy, is moving out of yourself towards the other person. That is true love. It moves out. Here's my favorite definition of love. Love is the movement out of narcissism. Narcissism holds on to itself. Love moves out, right? Now, you know, God is the only being in the universe who could justifiably be narcissistic, right? He is perfect. In fact, God can't really be narcissistic because God is his own community. Father loves son, son loves father. But even though God is perfect in himself, he moved out of himself first to create the world. You do know creation was an act of love. He moved out of himself. And then the incarnation, God leaving himself and becoming one of us. That's love. And let me end with one of my favorite moments in Narnia. Let's go back to the magician's nephew. Diggory has really screwed up, okay? But he wants to go to Aslan because back in London, Diggory's mother is dying of cancer. Diggory is the same age C.S. Lewis was when his mother died of cancer. It's the most autobiographical, and it's my favorite of the Chronicles. I think it's the most moving of the Chronicles. Diggory is terrified, but he walks up to Aslan. He's looking at his feet. Is there something you can do for my mother? And then Lewis says, in one of the most beautiful paragraphs, up until now, Diggory had been looking only at the paws of Aslan. But now, in his despair, he looked up at his face. What he saw amazed him more than anything in his life. For the golden head of Aslan was bent down towards his, and wonder of wonders, bright shining tears filled his eyes. They were such large, shimmering tears that for a moment Diggory thought that Aslan must be more sorry for his mother than he was. And then Aslan says, my son, I know grief is great. Only you and I in this land know that yet. Let us be good to one another. As the lion moves out towards Diggory, and then in an act of love, he allows Diggory to participate in making up for the terrible sin he did. It's not a punishment, it is a penance, but it's also a gift. I will allow you to cooperate in protecting Narnia from the evil that you have brought. You must go up to the top and pluck an apple and bring it back to me. Diggory gets to the sacred wood, and he does pluck the apple, and then the White Witch is there. She's now the White Witch. She has eaten of the apple, and she is now immortal and cannot die, but her face is white, white as salt. And then, I think this may be the single most difficult moral decision in any children's book I have ever read. The witch tries to convince Diggory to take the apple for himself. Bite of it, you will become immortal, and we will never die. And Diggory says, no, I think I'd rather just live a normal life and die and go to heaven. And then Lewis says, I think in those days, things like do not steal were more pushed into children's heads. They still are at your schools. Okay? Keep doing that. Okay. Now, that's the hard part. We think it's over. And then the witch says, if you won't take it for yourself, you've got these magic rings. Take it back to your mother. And it will heal her. And now Diggory knows that the most difficult choice in his life is in front of him. What is he going to do? Will he take it for someone else? And he does it in this incredible decision. He leaves, right? And there's a wonderful moment as he's flying back to Aslan. Lewis says that for several moments, Diggory was not even sure that he'd made the right choice. But then he thought about the tears in Aslan's eyes, and he knew he was right. The love of Aslan sustained him. And you know the story. When he goes back, Aslan uses the magic apple to grow a magic apple tree of protection. And then he tells Diggory to pluck an apple and give it to his mother. In your world, it will not bring eternal life, but it will heal. We need to teach, if we want our country to survive. And this is not part of my speech, but I want to end by just telling you one last thing, especially those of you that are teaching younger children. Your role is twofold. First of all, you must teach virtue, but that is not enough. You need to teach your students how to feel about virtue. Most of the time, you need to teach them. That may sound manipulative, but it's not. Right? You need to teach them. When my son was young and I said, Alex, I'm proud of you, you know what happened? The chest came out. He looked like a Greek. When I said, Alex, I was disappointed. You were irresponsible. I'm sad. Oh, like this. Now, I would go up to him and hug him and say, I still love you. The whole educational system of our culture right now is all about self-esteem, and children should never feel bad about themselves. We are going to create monsters. You cannot protect them from shame. Now, again, I would hug my son and say, I still love you. But I'm not telling you that what you did was okay. He needs to feel a sense of shame, right? And that is what... teenagers are what? Teenagers have always been wild. Here's the difference. The teenager in the 50s might be just as, prone to getting his teenage girlfriend pregnant. But there's a big difference. First of all, he might very well marry her, God forbid, okay? Today, it's not just they give you the sin. There's no sense of shame. It is our role to instill a sense of godly shame and the fear of the Lord together with wisdom. That's why the Book of Virtues gives us stories about virtues and stories about what happens when we choose the vice as opposed to the virtue. So remember that. Your job is not only to teach them the moral code, it's to teach them how to feel about it. Let's close in prayer. Father God, I thank you again so much for the teachers in this room, for the lives that they have invested in these children. Lord, help them not to grow weary. Give them vision. Give them faith, hope, and love that they can see the difference that they are making in the lives of students and in their own lives. Lord, let it begin here. Let the repairing of the ruins begin here and grow. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Thank you all. Very good. Thank you all. You made it. Thank you all. There is another session in here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go right outside. So if you have any questions or want me to sign books, I'll be right out there as long as you want.
In the Great Divorce, where there's a woman who's a glorious being.
Oh, yeah.
Has all the animals.
Yeah, it's all beautiful.
And her husband,
James
or stuff.
Yeah.
And C.S. Lewis makes a comment. Pity drives something. Are you familiar with
that? Yes, that's right.
What does that mean?
Well, you think of it. Pity can be the very thing that caused Christ to go down to hell.
Right.
But pity is bad when it manipulates and tries to make people miserable so you can pity them. It's a manipulative kind of pity that the husband, he calls him the tragedian.
Yeah, like right.
He is trying to manipulate her through pity. And that is a terrible thing.